Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Conscious Connection with Gary Stewart. I'm very excited to do my show today with author Dr. Deborah Sandella. She's a PhD and she has a new book coming out next week. It's Goodbye Hurt and Pain, Seven Simple Steps to Health, Love, and Success. And she's an award-winning international speaker, and she's the creator of RIM, which is Regenerating Images and Memory for Accelerated Healing of Mind and Body. And I know we can all use that. So this is Gary Stewart of Conscious Connection getting Dr. Deb on the line here. Hello,
yes,
Dr.
Hi.
Deb. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, Gary. How are you?
Very excited to have you on the show, especially in the before the launch of your book next week. So I'm very excited about it.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm so happy you're sharing my excitement. It makes it more fun.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's great to have innovative techniques out there for people to increase their healing. As you know, I do that as well. But now there's one of the questions I want to ask you. How does daydreaming help solve emotional issues?
Well, you know what's really interesting is there's certain things in our culture. We have a generally a left brain work ethic culture in general. You have a lot of drivers out there. And so what's happened as a result of that, we've kind of overlooked things like daydreaming, imagination, and think of them as wasting time or child's play. And the reality is the research is showing us that being able to move into our creative right brain actually has great value.
Yes, yes, and that's so overlooked in our type A kind of culture that's emerging in America here.
It is,
so
and especially, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, especially what?
Well, I was just going to say, to take that a little bit further, that the research really shows that when we daydream, we allow the executive left brain logic to be turned off just enough to allow all kinds of new, innovative, creative connections to go on in our brain, bringing together things we've never thought to bring together that our intellectual mind wouldn't bring together. And
right,
so absolutely. What happens, you get creative problem solving in a way that is quicker and more inventive.
And do you find that our emotional state or our feelings are important in this process much more than we think on a normal day?
Right, exactly. In fact, the all of the feelings, so our emotional self happens through the right brain, through the creative function that is connected to the body. So the neuroscience is now really demonstrating this, so that the images, like if you notice how you see a traumatic image, it really impacts you. And that it leaves a memory that's very strong,
right.
as does a pleasant image. And so this is how our unconscious starts to create all of these imprints in terms of what we're seeing. So we can actually use that and kind of manipulate it, you could say, so that we can unlock negative images that are memories that have gotten stuck, and we can regenerate them into new positive ones. And I know, Gary, you can relate to that, because in your work, there's also a regeneration of energy that's not been good into something that's good.
Yeah, we look at the ancestral realm in the constellation work and try to see the strength that was underlying the trauma and let the trauma go to the past where it belongs rather than propagate it in the present and future. Now, about emotions, though, now you have something intriguing here. What could be good about anger? I think that's a new take for our listeners.
Right. Well, again, in our culture, there's been a very strong bias that anger is bad. And I think, if we look into our history, we can find all the way back to Adam and Eve that, they were sent away from the garden because there was this emotional exchange exchange between the two of them. And then we go to Socrates, and there are papers that say that it's pretty much unvirtuous to be angry or jealous, so that there's this condemnation of certain feelings that has historically traveled down to us through the ages. So what we're finding, you know, in terms of our emotional self, our emotional operating system is what I call it, that, you know, that we have an organic emotional operating system, I call it EOS, that actually can manage feelings extremely well. We just haven't been using it correctly. We haven't known how to use it. So that feelings are like an inner compass, and they are transient states of awareness that just come in and pass through us. And as long as we receive them, but we don't attach to them or we don't resist them, they just continue to flow on out until they expire or they evaporate. And so what happens is in our culture, because we don't like anger, when we resist anger, then it's like building a wall to resist what is, you know, passing through. It's like if you think of feelings like a river flowing through and you build a dam, then the anger sticks around, actually. But it goes underground and it does damage. So when we actually receive it, anger is, again, it's like a compass. And anger particularly is very, very important because it lets us know that there may be danger about. So I like to compare it to a personal security alarm system. And I don't know if you have an alarm system in your house, Gary, but I know we do. And
many do, but yes, that's
Exactly. So what happens, we set the alarm, and most of the alarms are false alarms. However, we don't know till we investigate. So we need to check it out and find out, is there an intruder or not? And on the other hand, if we if we look at anger as that, when we get angry, what it's saying in our system is there may be an intruder. Now, that intruder may be in our external world, or it may be something within ourselves. We could have intrusive thoughts that are coming from someplace that could be dangerous to us, and or we could have people in our life that that relationship is having some things happen that may be a violation of our boundaries. And so we have to investigate to find out. So if we ignore anger, then we won't keep ourselves safe because we won't be listening for the alarm and then investigating. And if we assume that all alarms, that all every time we're angry, that it's true that there is an intruder and we're being violated, we're going to actually misjudge life, and we won't have trust in life. We'll, you know, because we know it, that's not always true. So it's a really important thing to pay attention to.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you have something else that's very intriguing. What's the trouble with empathy? So what are your thoughts on empathy?
Well, I grew up, first of all, I was born very empathic person and became a nurse originally. And in, you know, nursing school, we're taught to be empathic. And so what I've learned through my 66 years is that empathy itself, it can get you in trouble, because empathy is to stand in somebody else's shoes and to imagine being them. So when we are empathic, particularly around people who are in pain, then we're at risk of taking on their pain, which is not helpful to them, and it, of course, it's certainly not helpful to us. In fact, there's now there's research that watching terror attack victims on television for too long, people over-empathize with them, and they actually can experience secondary PTSD just from being a viewer because there's so much empathy. So I prefer to distinguish between empathy, where you're actually experiencing what somebody else is experiencing, to compassion. So with compassion, we can walk along beside somebody and really care about them and communicate caring and be with them without taking on their pain. Does that make sense to you, Gary?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's actually more supportive to be compassionate rather than in the same boat with, you know, PTSD. And, you know, I wonder how many... much violence America has in its movies if they're not shocking everyone in the theater with these horrific, violent things that, you know, our population is getting numbed.
Right. I think you're totally right because I've actually been doing some speaking on bullying and what parents and teachers and kids can do to interrupt it. And the reality is there are so many violent images around now. And we have in our brain, we have what's called mirror cells. And these mirror cells cause us to automatically, without even thinking about it, imitate what we see. And so we're bringing these children up with so many violent images, and then we're surprised when, you know, they're acting out and shooting and all of this. It's like, well, if you look around, that, they're just imitating those images.
I know, exactly. I always feel, I feel that all the time. And I said, you know, the censor, not that I believe in free speech, but gratuitous violence endlessly in entertainment for youths is not the way to go in a... when things are out of control in America anyway. And so what makes some memories stick and after a casual event is resolved?
Right. Well, what happens is the amount of what I would say intensity of emotion that's related to an experience is what will become the glue that causes it to stick. So if we have a fairly neutral experience, we may remember the facts, but it doesn't have significance emotionally for us. But if an event is extremely painful or it's also magnificently wonderful, we remember it. And when we remember it, we re-experience those feelings again. So what I've learned through the neuroscience and through the experience with REM is that the feeling itself, so the emotional memory, so the actual experience is now gone, it's dissolved, but the emotional memory, which is the emotion itself, can remain in the body if it hasn't been processed and digested. So it's a bit like, you know, we've heard that phrase, it's stuck in your craw.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's really what we're talking about. But what happens when it gets stuck in your craw, we no longer really know that it's there or what it's associated with. And so it becomes invisible. It's like an invisible screensaver that got saved years ago or maybe a year ago or maybe 2 weeks. It doesn't have to do with timing, really. It just has to do with the degree and intensity of the event. So what we can tell is when we're not having the results that we want, no matter what we do. So we're, I can always tell when people say, I'm trying as hard as I can. I keep doing everything to get this result that I want, which may have to do with relationship or health, or it may have to do with work success. And it's just not happening. It's like it just doesn't happen. So that means there's something stuck somewhere that is interrupting that natural progress. And in all these different kind of techniques, I know yours and in REM, that it is a way to access those blocks, those emotional blocks that are now invisible, and yet they're still there. And there are ways to make them visible. And the way REM makes them visible is through imagination and other techniques like yours. It's in a different way. However, they become known and they become visible in a physical way so we can actually work with them.
Right. So that empowers somebody. So once you can see it, you can let it go too. So it is really empowering.
It's very empowering because I know in your work it's probably true too, in REM, that the root cause is not known, like the root experience. It's just not known intellectually. I mean, yes, the person experienced it, and as it shows up through imagination and being sensed in the body, then it can be remembered. But like there was a woman one time who was in her early 30s who was doing very well professionally, but she had never done well with men. And she wanted to get married, she wanted to have children, and it just wasn't happening. In fact, she had really had very bad dating experiences. And so when we through the body sensed, went back to the source, the very first time, she went back to fifth grade, and all of a sudden there's an image. Her imagination brings this image of her being in fifth grade in the cafeteria line. And she doesn't really have a conscious memory of this because it was so long ago. So she had to look around and see, like, what's happening here? Well, as she's standing there, so she's watching, a fifth grade boy comes up and says, "You're ugly," to her. And she just shrinks, you know, because fifth grade girls, as I know, are very sensitive about how they look at how whether they're attractive or not at that age. And fifth grade boys are kind of don't have a clue how to talk to girls at that age. And so this had really stuck in her craw. As she was ugly. And so as we went back and began to really open up that memory and allow her in present time to explore it, she was able to say to him, "That hurt my feelings." So first of all, it gave her a voice. So she was no longer stuck in, you know, she was no longer frozen in fear. She was no longer silent. And then she went over and looked out of the boy's eyes to see what he wanted to say. And he said, "Gee, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. It's just that's how I talk to my guy friends. So it's I said it because I like you." And so this, as we know, is very realistic in terms of fifth grade boys. And that it changed her whole self-image because never in her whole life would she have thought he did it because he liked her. So all of a sudden, her frame of reference is I'm attractive to boys. So she then met a man in a few months, and they were engaged in a year. They now have two children. So, you know, it's just, it's amazing the root cause just isn't known intellectually.
And it's almost like she was carrying a false belief around that trauma that she was reinforcing unconsciously that really affected her ever since that day. And who would think trauma in a cafeteria would affect you that many years? You know?
Exactly. But you're exactly right. So what happens is like a bit of that self-fulfilling prophecy. So now, you know, she's got this image of herself in her body. So her body's holding that energy of being unattractive. What was interesting is when she walked out of my office, she walked out differently. She walked out gracefully like a beautiful woman. And when she had walked in, she looked frumpy. I mean, it was just dramatic.
Wow.
I was really impressed.
Yeah, and it's almost like those negative thoughts about herself, she reinforced them, you know, somatically on top psychologically. That's great. So that would be a good example of a stuck negative feeling. Now with parents,
that they're no longer aware of. That they're no longer aware, you know, that how when it started.
Fossilized memory that's plaguing you and you forget what the source is. So what is the biggest mistake parents make when they're trying to raise healthy children? Because I'm sure like this girl had an external event in school, but now being with your parents in a home situation where things can be either smooth or choppy, what do you feel is a mistake that parents make when they're trying to raise their children?
Well, I think, again, it really goes along with our culture. So, you know, parents really want to be the best parents they can be, and they love their children. So I want to be real clear about that. I've been a child, and I've also been a parent. So I know, you know, that parents really love their children. And we have had this bias against certain feelings. And so parents can try to talk their children out of certain feelings. Like I have known many people who have had their parents make fun of them because they were angry and when they were a child, because the parents are uncomfortable with anger, so they're going to even tickle the kid out of being angry. And it's like that's really a mistake because our feelings – are our radar, they're our system of how to keep ourselves safe in the world. And we want our children to learn to trust their instincts, to trust their feelings, and to test them out and learn what's true and what the information says and how to process that. So that instead of ever trying to talk your child out of their feelings, first of all, it's just to listen and let them have their feelings without any judgment. It doesn't mean you agree with it or disagree with it. You just let them have their feelings. And then to actually, when there are uncomfortable feelings, to go ahead and let them process it, you know, with you by talking about it. Because the biggest problems that I see in kids that have grown up, in fact, I was just, I'm just now working with a family with a young adult child who has a severe addiction issue, which we're seeing, of course, an epidemic of heroin addiction in our land. And that's what this is. And so what has happened in the family dynamics is anger has always been stuffed. So the parents never talked about anger with each other, never processed anger anywhere in the family. So the daughter was the one who had the most emotionality. So she was the area where it started to bubble up and show up. So she was the one who had the symptoms. Actually, she's the only one that's allowing true emotion. So she's the healthiest, actually, but it hasn't been accepted. So that's part of what I'm going to be doing with this family. I'm actually meeting with them tonight, is to allow this to now be change the family dynamic and the family taboo against anger, and to actually take them through a process of sharing their angry feelings with each other in a healthy, good way, so that they can learn that it's not all or nothing. That it's actually the process. You know, we communicate. And in communication, then that is a way of expressing emotion so that it flows out of our body. Again, like we don't, we're not meant to hold those feelings. They're meant to just come in, go out.
Exactly. Well, what is the quickest way to stop feeling overwhelmed? So, like, say someone in this family you just mentioned, say they're overwhelmed with anger or the rest of the family's uncomfortable with those emotions. So what is the quickest way to maybe stop that, not to cut it off, but to resolve it more so it can be less uncomfortable when it's expressed?
Right, exactly. Well, so what we want to do, because anger is a body experience, so anger and emotion happens in the body, in the cells in the body, and then it's communicated up to the brain for words. Now, when the mind gives it words, it may make up a story. It's not always true what the brain makes up, what the mind breaks makes up, but it will make up something, some kind of meaning. And so what we want to do first is to really give some attention to our body, because our body's struggling when it's in anger. Our body is in you know, a certain kind of tension and stress, because we're not meant to be angry all the time. So it's kind of like having a cough. It's like there we want to create a way for our body to physically express the anger, not about anybody or toward anybody, but just a physical discharge of some way. And so one thing we can do is actually to begin to focus on our body and close our eyes, because as soon as we close our eyes, we shift from left brain to right brain. That's the quickest way to shift over to your right brain. And then to begin to focus and on our breathing. And when we start to control our breathing, the breathing is an autonomic or an automatic process. So it actually connects our voluntary and involuntary nervous system. So it's the involuntary nervous system that connects to the emotions of fear and panic attacks and all of that. That's where, so we're then accessing both of those systems through breathing and controlling our breathing, and it pulls our attention to our body. So immediately we start to allow an expression from the body of tension. We start to relax, and we start to, you know, so we're no longer stuck, because we're really stuck in our angry thoughts. It's like being a walking, you know, a head without a body.
Right.
We now are disconnected from our body. And so when we reconnect with our body, it grounds the feeling so that it can start to be discharged in an organic way that's not dangerous, that's safe.
That's wonderful. We have a couple minutes left here, so I just want to, before we tell people where to get your book and when to get it here, now, in the book, you mentioned that you don't even have to talk about your feelings. How can that be? Is that what
right.
you're talking about, somatic expression?
Because that's been the way we always think of dealing with emotion is, well, we have to talk about it. The key word is about. Because as soon as we talk about something, we're distant from it. And when we're distant from it, we're in our left brain analyzing it. So nothing can happen there. Nothing, you know, we can feel it. We can get a little bit of discharge. We can feel a little better. We can do some problem solving. But we can't really go down into the deep emotional healing in our left, through our left brain. So that when we shift to the right brain, where we actually sense the emotion, the feelings in the body, and we go in and we start to actually embrace that feeling in the body and allow it to speak. So we start to give a voice to the parts of us that have been frozen in time. And when we do that, there's this an expression of the pain so it can leave the body. So it becomes a present time experience, and we begin to regenerate a new memory. So we allow the old memory to be expressed and released. And now a new experience just organically comes in. Because that we're really made, you know, we're very resourced, as you know, Gary, and because you see that in your work too. We're really born with such capacity to heal in ways that we just haven't been understanding and using.
And you are definitely on the cutting edge here. Our time is running out here. So, unfortunately, my God, I could talk for an hour. You're just so knowledgeable. And just I hope our listeners are really enjoying this, because it's going to be great for them to read the book to get more in depth and maybe even contact you. So it's been wonderful to talk to you. Is there any, well, we have about a minute or a little over a minute left. Is there something you'd like to close with about the book so our audience can get excited about buying it next week?
Sure. Well, what I would like to share is that the book has lots and lots of real-life stories of people that really touch you. You know, they'll bring sometimes tears to your eyes and also smiles to your face by the end of the story. And that they all, it also includes all the neuroscience in a very understandable way. My 25-year-old daughter said, "I really like the way you put the research in. It was like a little blurb."
Good. Yeah,
so it's not
good.
Too much.
Right,
and,
exactly.
Right. And then at each chapter, the seven steps, each step, there are practice-it-yourself activities at the very end that you can do for yourself or you can do practice together. It's actually a great book to do a book club where you could move through the chapters, because you have everything built into every chapter to have a magnificent experience. And what a discussion. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. So that would be a lot of growth. Well, we have to close now, Dr. Deb. It's been wonderful to talk to you today, and it's so informative, and I love that it's science-based and emotional and cathartic all at the same time. So for our listeners of Conscious Connection here, I've been interviewing Dr. Deborah Sandella. Her book that's coming out next week on Amazon is Goodbye, Hurt and Pain, 7 Simple Steps to Health, Love, and Success. I'm going to put all her contact information on the link when I release it, and it's going to be available on Amazon. So I'll be sharing all that with you, and her website is www.riminstitute.com. And Deb, thank you so much, Dr. Deb. It's been wonderful to speak to you and so informative and enlightening. I can't thank you enough for being on Conscious Connection.
Oh, thank you, Gary. It's been so much fun to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. And to our listeners of Conscious Connection, namaste.